Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 290. Nobody owns land. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And first of all, we want to wish a happy Rosh Hashanah, a happy Jewish New Year to those who celebrate. And before we get started with our conversation, I just want to make a little bit of a New Year's fundraising pitch, because this is often a time of year where people think about their Jewish giving in particular. And if Judaism Unbound or Jewish Live or any of our projects has been meaningful to you in the past year, we hope you'll really consider making a small contribution at www.judaismunbound.com/donate. We're really just asking for you to consider a gift on the order of $1 for every hour of content that you've spent with us in the last year. For some, that might be about $50. For some, that might be about $18. Something like that would be an incredible gift to help us start this year and to create a community of thousands and thousands of people who are supporting this work in a small way, which really adds up and allows us to continue doing this work. So we're not at thousands and thousands of people yet, but I think it's really achievable. So again, the way to do that is to go to www.judaismunbound.com/donate. And while you're there, check out our newest project, the UnYeshiva. You can get to it just by going to the judaismunbound.com homepage and clicking on UnYeshiva. And that is a new digitally driven learning platform that we hope is going to expand to be offering dozens and dozens of classes. Right now, it is launching with two classes. Lex is teaching a class called Jewish Discontinuity, which is examining the most ancient of Jewish traditions, which is upending Jewish tradition. And I am teaching a class called Leadership in a Time of Wandering, where we're going to be taking a deep dive into a variety of Jewish texts from the Torah, primarily around the life of Moses, and also from the Talmud. And we're going to be looking at various leadership and innovation ideas from our own contemporary times outside of the area of Jewish writing and thinking. So you see that there are connections between these classes. They flow from our Judaism Unbound philosophy, and that will continue to be the philosophy of the UnYeshiva. These are going to be semester-long classes, 12 weeks, starting in early October, and you can find out all about it and register at the UnYeshiva, which you can easily find from the Judaism Unbound homepage. So now let's turn to our conversation today. We are continuing on this subject of the Shemitah year, which now we can say starts next week. That's the year that comes around every 7 years, and it is a time for letting the land rest and forgiving debts. And we have thought a lot about some of those things metaphorically and whether they can be extended beyond those specific areas in a more contemporary time, whether we can reimagine Shemitah to have a much broader applicability. So our guest today, David Seidenberg, is an expert in Jewish spirituality, Jewish spiritual ideas, and their application to the earth. He is the author of a book called Kabbalah and Ecology, God's Image in the More Than Human World. And he is also the founder of a website called neohasid.org. That's neohasid.org, which teaches eco-Torah, new liturgy, and Hasidic melody. David Seidenberg has a doctorate and rabbinical ordination from the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. That's the major seminary of conservative Judaism. And he also has a second rabbinic ordination from Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, the founder of the Jewish Renewal Movement. So David Seidenberg, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you.
So we wanted to start, as we're exploring this topic of the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year, that I read an article that you wrote about basically making the argument that Shemitah is at the center of everything. Could you talk a little bit about why you think that, or what it means to think of it as at the center of everything?
Sure. Basically, the Torah is coming to solve a problem. The problem is that, at least according to our stories, but I think also according to reality, the relationship between humans and the earth was in continuous degeneration, process of getting worse and worse. That's what our stories tell. And corresponding with that, according to our stories, the relationship between humans and God was also getting worse and worse and worse. Until after the flood, God said, I give up. I'm never going to make any connection between humans and the earth anymore. Forget it. And then Abraham comes along and God says, what if I try this one family and this one land? Maybe they can get it right. So that's how I see the frame of the whole Torah. And Genesis Bereshit is clearly describing that as the foundation for why there is a Torah in the first place. We already know that creation is our focus, the wholeness of creation, the goodness of creation, and that we root this in the idea of seven, the recurring pattern of seven. We have the 7 days that are the Shabbat cycle, every seventh being, of course, the Sabbath, the end of the cycle. And we have the seventh month, which is when Rosh Hashanah happens, according to the official Torah version of the Jewish calendar, even though we think of it as the first month. And we have the seventh year. We also have the 7 weeks of the Omer. All these cycles of seven are building up into one grand scheme, one grand vision. The grand vision is a society that can fully keep what Sabbath means, which is to deeply honor both creator and creation. That's the human purpose. More specifically, according to second and third chapter of Genesis, the purpose of the human being is to serve the ground. The Adam's purpose is la'avod et ha'adama. How do we serve the ground?
I just want to reinforce something that you said just for people who don't know, because this is the first time I've heard it, and it's fascinating to me, this idea. So the word la'avod, I've often encountered as just having two different meanings. You know, one is to serve, like to serve God. You can often say la'avod God. And other times you say la'avod is to work, like to work the land. And it's so fascinating to me just to reinforce and to hear what you're saying, that when we talk about la'avod the land, to work the land, another way to read it is to serve the land with the same word, and that has real deep meaning. That's a great perspective.
It's usually translated as to work the land. And work the land is an act of domination. You work the land, essentially it means you make the land work for you. That is not what the Hebrew means. There's no chance that that's what the Hebrew means. The formulation, la'avod et ha'adama, la'ovda u'lashomra, which happens again also in chapter 2, to work the land as it's usually translated and to guard it, but actually it means to serve the land and to watch over her. The grammar of that is absolutely not different from the grammar of the second paragraph of the Shema, where we say, ul'avdo b'chol avavachem, to serve the one, meaning God, to serve him, to use the gendered pronouns, to serve God with your whole heart. Now, with God, we're supposed to serve with our whole heart. That's a different level. That is a higher level of serving, right? But with the earth, we're supposed to serve with our strength, essentially, right? The assumption is that we are giving our strength to the land, giving service to the land. It's true that the way our ancestors understood serving the land is to do agriculture in a good, holy way. They thought of that as serving the land, not serving themselves. And that's why in the second chapter of Genesis, it says that there was nothing growing from the land because there was no human yet to serve the land. So the purpose of the human, the creation of the human, is to serve the land so that things can grow. In other words, our purpose is not to be at the top of creation in the hierarchy, but to be at the center, making sure everything keeps going and it's functioning and cycling. That's the human purpose. That human purpose was ruined in many different ways, according to our stories. And in the story of the flood, we hear again and again, it says 7 times about the evil and the violence that the humans did. But in every single time that it mentions it, it says the violence of the human beings was ruining the land. It never says the violence of the human beings was bad because it was hurting other people or because it was hurting this or that other creature, right? It always says that it was hurting the land. That seems to be God's concern. So God has a covenant with the land. God makes a covenant with the land when the flood story ends. And God makes a covenant with all the animals when the flood story ends. 2 covenants that are intertwined. There is no covenant with human beings after the flood story. It's a covenant with all life, not with human beings specifically. That's something that we usually forget about. It's so important to notice.
I love that we started and asked about Shemitah, about the sabbatical year, which if you look at, say, the Wikipedia entry or most what is Shemitah definitions, they would start with a book, but it wouldn't be Genesis. They would start with Leviticus. Mm-hmm. In terms of like where the rules, regulations of the sabbatical year are laid out, it's in the book of Leviticus. In starting with Genesis, and starting with the literal beginning of it all, the creation of the world, you're helping, I think, really persuasively show how the seven map, I'm big on seven, I'm really with you on that, how the seven map is there right from the beginning, and that Shemitah is that culmination, or at the very least, the sabbatical year is one culmination, and then there's also the Jubilee year, which I'm sure we'll end up talking about that some more too, but that's the seven sevens, the 49, yeah. 49 or 50. But because people might be sitting there thinking, wait, what about like Leviticus, where Shemitah is actually described? Like, could you just give us a little bit of a practical, what does the Bible say these rules, regulations are? Like, what is actually supposed to happen these 7 years? Because I've noticed in myself and with some of the conversations I've been having with folks that I'm so eager to talk about the importance of Shemitah, the why of Shemitah, that I like get lost. And I don't say like, ah, yes, there are these particulars that are described. That's what we're actually sort of doing practically. And for folks who don't know what it is already, that's a really useful hook.
What we find in every mention of Shemitah is that in the Shemitah year, we have to let the land rest. And whatever grows from the land is not owned by the farmer, is not owned by the human society or community, but rather it belongs to everyone, which includes the worker, the settler, the stranger, and the wild animals. And the Torah is very explicit that the wild animals need to be able to eat anything that grows in your field, unlike other years where you might say this is our human space. So part of the Shemitah idea is to break down the distinction between what is human space and what is wild space. Any idea that something is owned or belongs to the farmer or the owner of land, which is already a concept that is quite suspect, is broken down in the Shemitah year. So I'm not allowed to gather what grows in my land, to harvest it and to store it and then to sell it. I'm not allowed to sell anything that grows in the Shemitah year. I'm not allowed to eat anything unless other people have access to that same food. But more importantly, the rabbis learned from this idea that the Shabbat Haaretz, what grows from this in the Sabbath year from the land, should be for you and for your servants and for your ger, the one who is a stranger living with you, and for your animals and for the wild animal, l'chayat ha-sadeh. What the rabbis learned from this is you're not even allowed to eat something in your house unless it's also growing in the field so that wild animals can eat it. So this is in a way almost an esoteric idea of Shemitah, but it's actually a central question in halacha, in Jewish law. How do you observe Shemitah? You can only observe Shemitah fully by refraining from eating anything that the wild animals can't also eat. So you're going back to a kind of strict idea of being a locavore, to use modern terminology. You're going back to a kind of permaculture. Whatever grows by itself is what you can eat, but it must be shared. You're breaking down the idea of nationalism also, because the nation owns the land, right? In some ways of understanding nationalism, it's the nation that owns the land. No, the land is mine, God says. It doesn't belong to you. The person who is counted as a toshav, what I'm translating as settler, is someone that doesn't own the land. They're passing through it. They're stopped there, but they don't take possession of it. So our Torah tells us, one of the foundations of morality is to recognize that you are also a stranger and to recognize that you are ger v'toshav, which is what Avraham calls himself when he comes to Canaan. He says, I'm ger v'toshav. I'm stranger and settler, meaning I don't own this. It's not my right to be here, but I'm coming through. The message of Shemitah is that we're all in that state. So there's two dimensions to this. One is that humans belong everywhere on the planet, that we have a kind of right as a species, or perhaps more accurately, a capacity to live in every ecosystem. We have the intelligence to figure out how to live in every place. We don't have to be evolved naturally to only live in that place. We can find ways to adapt through culture. But at the same time, we don't own any place. We're here not to work the land, not to take possession of it, but to serve it. The other thing about the Shemitah that's really important to note is that according to Leviticus, the land has a right to rest. It's an absolute right. The land desires her Sabbaths. She doesn't just have a right to them, she desires them. And she will make them happen. What making them happen means is that if we don't give the land a rest, then the land will get a rest by God getting rid of us. The whole framework of Shemitah tells us, if you want to honor justice between homeborn and stranger, between people and animals, between humanity and the land, then you will have a kind of right to be in the land, not that you own it, but that you belong to it. If you don't do that, then you have no right, and God will take the side of the land against humanity. So Shemitah, in one way, is a way of preventing us from getting into that state.
So I'm worried that what I'm about to ask sounds kind of simple-minded, and maybe everybody understands what I'm about to say, but for me, it's all of a sudden an insight. But I wanted to share with you that when you were talking particularly earlier about Genesis and about that story, that idea that before the flood, there was a certain relationship with the earth and with the animals that we were, that human beings were being invited to have, and then they totally messed that up, and then the flood came and destroyed everything. And, you know, I'm always skeptical about this stuff as history, and I'm always asking questions like, this didn't really happen, or did they even do the Shemitah in the first temple period? But listening to you, I was like, wow, I'm listening to prophecy, not history, meaning I'm listening to a description of what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And we just recently, this UN report came out that basically said that climate change is now irreversible, and for the next 30 years, it's going to be a rise in temperatures, and there's nothing we can do to stop it. The only question is, maybe we could stop it for after 30 years from now. And I'm like, wow, this is all just happening. And it's not a punishment per se. It's not like there's some being out there punishing us. It's like, this is just what's happening. This is just the natural consequences of an attempt to subjugate the earth, which we've been doing, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, or, you know, and of course before that too, but accelerated. What you see is the natural ecosystem kind of putting itself, you know, back into equilibrium. And the result of that is floods and disasters and all kinds of things like that. And so I guess my question is, as we listen to what you're saying now, is that really the crux of where we should be taking this thinking, to say, yeah, let's understand this in the context of the world in which we live right now, where whether it ever happened before, it's happening right now, almost just like it was described.
That's a great framework, Dan. The thing to remember is that this is not the first time in history that it's happened. It's only the first time in history that it's been the entire planet that it's happening to. But there have been extinctions caused by human beings. There have been extinctions of human cultures because of the ecological ruin that they created all through history. It's just that usually it's one region, one ecosystem, and then the humans go off to another ecosystem, which they either ruin again, or perhaps they've learned from their experience and they decide not to ruin the next ecosystem they end up in. Our culture is rooted in a perhaps not an historical memory, but maybe a mythical memory of what happened in Mesopotamia, in the civilization of Sumer, where they did over-irrigate the land, they raised the water table, the land became salted by the water that came up from the earth, soil salinization. And first they went from growing wheat to growing barley, and then eventually they couldn't grow anything and they left. And there's no civilization there anymore. That civilization gave us the plow. It gave us writing, so much. And yet it couldn't sustain itself because of what it did ecologically, because of the agriculture that it pursued, which inherently wore down the land. Our ancestors always talk about the ancestors coming from Mesopotamia. Abraham comes from Mesopotamia. Avram, Jacob goes back in that direction. It's clear that there's some connection there, some kind of memory. Our ancestors imagined that you could have an agriculture that didn't do that. They understood that humanity had to go on a different track, to go in a different direction, to change the course of the Anthropocene so it wouldn't end up exactly where we are now. The mission reaches its culmination in the Shemitah year. Create a society that can truly honor the Sabbath on this deepest level for a whole year. And then the seventh Shemitah, to go on an even deeper journey of letting go of the land, of creating equality between human beings. So there's lots of parts of that mission that involve individual mitzvot commandments that we do and all kinds of things about justice and human relationships that are good for all times and in all places. But they all lead up to a society that has the possibility of observing something as complicated and grand as a Shemitah year. Every week we have a Shabbat because every week we're practicing to be ready to do Shemitah. And yet the mission has failed. We never completed the mission, and we may never get to at this point because we don't know how much longer human civilization is going to hold out in the face of what's going on right now. And you know what? A Torah that serves a version of capitalism that destroys the earth is not a Torah worth continuing. You know, and that's the Torah we're living in now, more or less, even though that's not, it's clearly not the message of the Torah. The only religion that's worth following is a religion that teaches how to live sustainably on the earth. Every other religion is a waste. That's true of, could be true of a religion as a whole, and it could be true of a particular version or sect of a religion.
So I made a claim in our episode with the Shemitah Project recently that I want to bounce off you, because I'm actually, it's not at all clear to me whether you will agree with me or strongly disagree, but it does feel clear to me that you'll have cool things to say. So my claim is that whether it's the rabbis or sort of Jews beyond the rabbi, like we messed up. We messed up because we had a set of rituals in the Torah, we had a lot of them, that you could read in one of two ways. You could read them as specifically things that you would do only in the land of Israel, or you could read them as things you do anywhere, but it talks about Israel because that's like sort of the geographic location that the text is concerned about. But if you go to some other land, you apply those rules there too. And what we did is we did actually different strategies with different pieces of the Torah's commandments. So like with the pilgrimage festivals, Sukkot, Shavuot, Passover, like it is very clear in the text. We seem to have forgotten this. Like in the text of the Bible, those happen at a specific place, at the temple in Jerusalem. There's a bunch of sacrifices, etc. But the rabbis, and not even just the rabbis, other Jewish groups that weren't rabbis, they made the, I don't know, executive decision. They made the call as a collective that we're going to do Sukkot, we're going to do Passover, we're going to do Shavuot, we're going to do those everywhere in the world, even though you could read it as sort of, oh, they're done because we're not in this one land anymore, or we don't have this one temple anymore. But with Shemitah, we read it in a way that suggested, oh, this was only about one land. It was about Haaretz. It was about the land of Israel and not land wherever the land is in the world. And so we stopped, whether we were ever doing it is a whole other question. But at the very least, even if we were doing Shemitah at one point, we stopped because Jews were elsewhere in the world. And the idea was that you can't really mark these rituals, this relationship to land, if you're not in one specific land. And so I was curious, like, do you agree with me that this was a mess up, like that we should have actually said, you know, this one could be transported around the world too, and our relationship to land is not about relationship to one land, but rather with the planet? Or would you say, like, well, maybe it's more complicated than that? How would you approach that?
Probably it's more complicated choice, but basically, it takes a huge social infrastructure for Shemitah to work out. It's not a choice that an individual makes. It's not a choice that a farmer makes. It's a choice that a whole society makes. So it makes sense that it would be very hard to demand people try to observe that outside of the land where they don't actually control should go in quotes, but, you know, control or manage their relationship to the land, where they're subject to other people's definition of what the relationship to the land is going to be. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't learn from Shemitah and apply that to how we live in the lands, wherever, whichever land we're in. Our rules and rituals are both a vision of how all humanity can be living sustainably in relation to the earth, but they're also a vision of specifically how this people could live in this specific ecosystem. And some of our rules really only apply to that ecosystem. The rain season ends, and that's Passover, and that's the beginning of the wheat growing and the barley harvest. We go 7 weeks later to Shavuot, and that's the end of the wheat harvest and the beginning of the fruit. They happen to match. This is not true in every ecosystem, that one thing ends and the next thing begins. That's a beautiful, amazing thing. And our holidays keep us keyed to that reality to the extent that we remember that it exists. For many generations in many places in the Jewish world, The only memory of the holidays was what they meant historically, or I should say mytho-historically, like this is about the leaving of Egypt. This is about the giving of the Torah. Sukkot is about something sort of fuzzy, like living in tents in the desert. Okay, but it happens at a particular time for agricultural reasons, not for any other reasons, for agricultural reasons. It keeps us keyed to a specific ecosystem. That ecosystem is a rain-fed agriculture. Mesopotamia was a river-fed agriculture. They're vastly different ecologically, practically, technologically. There's nothing you can do in a rain-fed agriculture on hills to force fertility on the land. You're dependent on the rain. In Mesopotamia, you weren't dependent on the rain. You could use the Tigris and Euphrates to water whatever you wanted to. And so in a sense, humans felt they were in control of their fertility, of the land's fertility. Same thing in Egypt. And when you're in control, you can go to various extremes of injustice without being afraid that the whole system's going to upend itself. That wasn't existing in Canaan. There were no stable sources of anything. And that's what our ancestors wanted. That's what they craved. They wanted a world in which they would do wrong in Cheshvan, which is the sort of the beginning of winter months. Then when they came at the end of winter in Shvat, there would be consequences already. You know, like your wheat would not have gotten enough rain because there were immediate consequences. Now, they had a mythical idea of those consequences. You do something bad and then God stops giving you rain in this kind of almost clockwork way. And we know, of course, it's much more subtle, complicated. But that's what they were craving. They were craving a relationship of immediate feedback with the land and with God. Not every ecosystem even has the potential to do that. So that's a particular way of understanding how to live sustainably in the land. Shemitah is based on all of these things building up into a sustainable structure. So that isn't going to work in every place in the world. But the basic lessons that we don't own the land, that we don't have a right to the land, that the land has a right to rest, that the land is a person, a subject in covenant with God, that can apply everywhere, even though ecologically the lessons of how you make that real and vivid might differ from one place to the other.
I wanted to come back to the kind of mytho-historical framing that you gave at the beginning, because I was thinking about another element and also relating it to what we've heard recently about climate change, which is that, at least I was listening to a description on the New York Times podcast, The Daily, about this UN climate change report recently. And they basically asked the reporter, like, well, what can we do about it? And the answer was kind of like, on the one hand, there's nothing we can do about it because it's happening. And on the other hand, we have to do something about it. And as I was listening to your framing of the mytho-historical idea that after the destruction of the flood, at some point God said, all right, I'm going to try one more time with this guy Abraham and his little model community, and let's see if that works. And I would raise the question of, like, did it work? I mean, it seems like maybe it didn't work. But if we're going to try it again, that actually makes some sense to me. So following on what you're saying about, yeah, in different ecosystems, there's going to be different ways to do Shemitah, and maybe the exact laws as we read them in Leviticus and elsewhere, or in the Talmud, or in the Jewish codes, like those specific laws aren't the ones that we should be enacting in order to truly live out Shemitah now, at least not in a lot of places in the world, but yet we should do. So I guess I'm wondering, like, what's your vision, what's your imagination about how either the Jews themselves, ourselves, should try again to be that model community? And or are there things that we can be doing, not specifically as Jews, to try to bring the idea of being a model into a more real world instantiation?
We have two Shemitahs in the Torah. One is the one mentioned in Exodus, Tishmitena Unatasha, you should release, not take what comes from the land for yourself. That's one version. That's what's elaborated in Leviticus 25. And in Parsha Bechukotai, the Parsha, the Torah portion that comes right after, is the one that tells us that the land will get her Sabbaths whether you let her or not, and you will get wiped out if necessary in order for that to happen. So that's one Shemitah, is all those texts add up to one Shemitah. The other Shemitah is the one of Deuteronomy, which says that you release all debts in the Shemitah year. So another way of reaching deep equality, social equality, overcoming injustice, overcoming poverty, releasing all debts. our civilization had different stages at which it understood we need a different kind of Shemitah. Deuteronomy is later than the rest of the Torah. I don't want to say anything about who did or didn't write the Torah. From my perspective, it's all Sinai on a mythic level, and that's how I experience it. But it's responding to a later stage of civilization where money was a major driving force, more than, in some ways, more than agriculture. And so we have a different kind of Shemitah for that. Both Shemitahs happened in an agricultural world, though, where anything that humans got or made or created came from nature, what grows, what's on the surface of the earth. Our civilization is based on what can be extracted from inside the earth. It's based on the oil, the petroleum, you know, go through all the precious metals and the neodymium and all the things that we use for our newfangled eco-batteries and on every level, our computers. But even before that, it's based on extraction, not on what grows, not on agriculture. We don't have a Shemitah for extraction. It's not clear how one would get to that. But what is clear is that just as there is a Shabbat or a Shemitah for agriculture and for money, there needs to be something for extraction. What would it mean to have a Shemitah from taking petroleum from the earth? I mean, we need more than a Shemitah. We need a complete stop. But even if we get a Shemitah, that would be a big step to even figure out how we could survive by taking a pause in what we extract from the earth.
This is huge. I mean, this to me, this is where you and I are synthesizing the two pieces that disagreed on one level before, right? Where I said there was a mess up and you said, well, it's more complicated than that. Like, it's not just that we messed up. We recognized that there were certain elements of Shemitah that were unique to the ecosystem of the land described in the Torah. So it's not so simple as to just like do the same thing in the rest of the world. And I'm very much persuaded by that. But what you just said, like, we need a Shemitah from extraction. We need, as a society, as a world, to cease that element of our relationship to the planet, that's where I'm thinking, right? Like, it's inaccurate of me to blame the rabbis a while ago on that. I do think we would have benefited if there were efforts in Europe or in North Africa or in wherever to take Shemitah and be like, oh, what? Let's workshop this for our ecosystem, right? Like, if that had been an effort.
That would have been amazing.
That's where I think we're really finding something. And then my so what question is, okay, so we didn't for a few thousand years. You said, you know, it's unclear how we would do that with extraction. But I'm curious, like, can you help us workshop a little bit, think out loud a little bit of what we might do today, whether it's on that, whether it's our relationship to extraction, or just how we would do the mapping work, the application work of taking a Shemitah from one context, an ecosystem that is not ours if we don't live in Israel, and applying it to other lands. Like, what would you sort of prescribe?
Yeah, there are two tracks. One is, what should the Jews be doing in the different lands that they're in? The other is, what kind of equivalent of Shemitah, of sustainability, did the indigenous people of the that land work out? So human beings that colonize generally impose a culture that is not rooted in the ecosystem, on an ecosystem. Generally, that process is destructive of the ecosystem. Generally, a colonial culture will work out some kind of more sustainable way of doing its practices over time. But generally, human destructive power is so great that it happens too quickly for cultures to evolve, to not actually destroy things. So that's the world we're in. But we had cultures that evolved slowly over thousands of years or tens of thousands of years that we think of as indigenous cultures that evolved to fit a specific ecosystem, like many of the Native American tribes in North America or the Maori in New Zealand. In our reckoning, the human civilization is 5,782 years old as of Rosh Hashanah. So that's how old human civilization is according to our stories. But the Maori have a civilization that's like 70, 80,000 years old. If there's any proof that our stories are not history, that's a great proof that our stories are not history. They're something other than history. Cultures that use the earth in a way that evolves slowly enough have time to learn how to do that sustainably. Cultures that do that too quickly which is essentially what our technology does. It teaches us how to do everything too quickly, right? Those civilizations won't develop the practices they need to live sustainably. Then they will face a cataclysm. Those people who survive will face a reckoning. How can we remake our culture so that it could be sustainable for what's left? It's quite possible, since we know that in New Zealand and in North America, there were megafauna that were wiped out by the cultures that were before the cultures that we think of as the indigenous ones, you know, the first humans that came to that place. It's quite possible that those cultures evolved after they witnessed an ecological cataclysm, and then that brought them to the realization of having a different kind of culture. So the same way that I'm saying that our ancestors had some kind of memory of the destruction in Mesopotamia, the ecological cataclysm of Mesopotamia, that led to this different sustainable culture. So every indigenous culture has some wisdom about that land. And the first thing to learn is what was their wisdom about how to essentially make Shemitah, treat the land as a person with rights. That's what Shemitah is on the most fundamental level. A person has rights. A person has legal standing. A person has claims on all other beings that are seen as persons. I mean, one of the things that we need to recognize is that from our ancestors' perspective, sustainability doesn't just come from how you treat the land. It comes from how you treat other people. And just relationships between people are also a foundation of sustainability. For the land itself, we have the idea that injustice pollutes and harms and ruins the land. That's the flood story telling us that, right? And the standards of injustice are especially how you treat the poor, the orphan, and the stranger. We're not doing well on that front either.
I know you don't want to talk about who wrote the Bible. I always like talking about who wrote the Bible. And I imagine that the laws of Shemitah were written during the Babylonian exile, where people are asking, you know, why were we exiled from our land? And one of the ideas is that they look back and they say, you know, we've had these kingdoms for about 500 years and we never practiced the Shemitah. And, or maybe this is when they get back from the Babylonian exile, like, we had to pay 70 years for 500 years of missed Shemitahs. You know, when I think about the calendar now that we've missed about 2,000 years of Shemitahs, it seems like we owe the land about 300 years, and that's chilling. But we've also been talking about science fiction. I often talk about Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy, where the hero's great discovery is that he can find a way to change the 10,000 years of suffering of the Galactic Empire into only 1,000 years of suffering. But I was thinking about this last year plus of COVID as a version of reflecting on some of what you're talking about, because I'm thinking about how sometimes when people talk about Shemitah, it sounds so fantastical. Like, what, we're going to give up gasoline for a year, or we're going to give up this or that for, you know, I'm talking about Shemitah of extraction that you were talking about, and thinking like, well, really, are people going to give up gasoline for even a year? But, you know, 2 years ago, if you would have said everybody's going to give up travel for a year, people would have laughed. And I guess what I'm saying, though, is that COVID feels like kind of an example. Again, I'm talking mythically here. I don't actually think it was a punishment by a knowing being out there. But the idea that if you think you can't do this, it might happen to you without your choice. And one potential learning from the COVID-enforced Shemitah is that actually we can survive a year without travel. We can survive a year with only using minimal gas because we're not going anywhere. And the question would come from there. Now that we've had, the entire world has had this Shemitah enforced upon us, now that the very next year, here comes the real Shemitah, how might that get us thinking differently about what's possible?
For sure, the pandemic has taught us that there are some things we can stop that we didn't even know we could stop. And that should give us a feeling of empowerment about what's possible. What do we want to do for this Shemitah year is another question. And that's a specific question for farmers and a more general question for human beings. Like, one of the things about Shemitah is that the release of debts is considered obligatory in all the world, not just in the land of Israel. So do you have someone that owes you money that you can say to them, I don't need that money, it's the Shemitah year. But if you want to give it to someone, let's give it to, say, this fund to address climate change, or this fund to buy back land for indigenous peoples. That seems like a very appropriate use for that money. So that could apply to everyone. Another thing can happen on the ritual level is, what do you want to do every time you eat a piece of fruit or eat anything, right? Should we have a special kavana, a special intention that directs our minds to what we're trying to achieve? Like I wrote this harachaman, a special additional blessing you add to the prayers you say after eating, that talks about returning our hearts to the land. We could have prayers like that that people say all the time. It doesn't matter whether you say the normal official blessing. You could still say a special blessing related to Shemitah about returning your heart to the earth, returning your connection to the land. But that, it's not clear that that makes any difference with respect to climate change, right? Like, how many iterations of rituals do you need before it actually amounts to a difference in how people live their lives or structure their civilizations? So we can do all these little things that seem nice and that make us feel good. And I think they're worth doing because I think they strengthen our resolve, but they don't actually change the way society works. Some of the changes can't happen on the level of our communities. They have to happen on the level of whole industries. And we don't have the power to make that happen just as a Jewish community. So that involves policymaking. It involves lobbying. It involves pressure. There's some question, can we even put enough pressure to even possibly imagine that we're going to do anything that makes a difference, given how dire things are? It's not clear, but we have to try. But the other thing I wanted to say, things are going to be bad. The losses that are going to happen in the world might be ones that require, demand of us tremendous grieving. We need to find a way to encounter and interact with this harsh reality that's going to be happening so that we don't get frozen and paralyzed, so that we still have power to do what we can do, which means creating the space to truly grieve what we're doing and what we've done and not get stuck in despair or depression. There's a lot of rituals that are coming from the eco-spirituality movement about this, many of which can fit into a Jewish context. But we also are, you know, ritual experts as Jews for finding ways to connect with grief in a way that's very constructive and useful and helpful to people. So we do that with individual human lives. We have wonderful processes for mourning. What Kaddish do you say when an animal goes extinct? It becomes a very deep question. And the question is, do we have the spiritual resilience to meet the reality? The temptation as climate change effects become worse is going to be for people to move towards fascism, because they're going to want a strong government to make sure that they get food. And that could include also making sure those bad people from other countries don't come here, because they're going to cause us to starve, because they're going to take our food. And so what if they starve? Like, that's a very real direction that politics could go. And we have the spiritual resources to stop that from happening.
I'm so deeply with you, and I'm grateful to you for bringing such like an integral lens that takes a realistic look at what's possible and also what isn't without entire industries shifting. I don't think I'm disagreeing with you. I do want to explore the extent to which we do have power. And I'm not going to claim that Jewish communities have, I mean, I'm certainly not going to claim the kinds of anti-Semitic tropes that Jews have all the power, et cetera. But I don't want to say that we have no power. And I'm actually flashing to what you said before about how Shabbat we could understand as a practice for Shemitah. Shabbat is a micro version of something that is over 300 times as long as Shabbat. Like, it is, you do it every week as a way of prepping for something that's an entire year. If we understood our local synagogue or our local Jewish community or something like that as practice for entire industries, for entire societies, and we said, how am I and a collective of people going to push my synagogue, not that this is going to solve climate change, but how is my synagogue going to be an exemplar, going to be a kind of Shabbat, going to shift our relationship to extraction, maybe shift our relationship to the land that we're on, participate in the kinds of things you said in terms of supporting those who are indigenous to the land, think about debt relief, think about like economics of synagogue, like how, if we were on a community by community level going to do that, I think that could actually be powerful. And I think that if those communities, like I envision a world, non-trivially, like if there were 700 Jewish organizations during Shemitah that were out really publicly, I mean, pick your issue, like calling for a Green New Deal, like calling for like the kinds of policies that may not save us, but at the very least would demonstrate a sincere effort. That is a level of power if we all committed to it. And so I'm invested in that. And I'm invested in steps that we could take on a ritual level, like you described with your Harakamon that you're going to be saying every day. I'm interested in steps that could create such a repetitive reminder of the call of this year that it would filter up into, or that it could at least filter up into broader systems. What should people be thinking of their role in terms of, I'm going to say like agitating, I don't mean it in a negative way, but like in terms of helping their communities, whether that's official synagogue communities or just their friends who are Jews or just their friends who are people, take on the obligations that you're describing, contribute to something that could potentially move industries, move politics long term.
Religious community in general, and of course, Jewish religious community, is a space in our society in which our relationships are not based on transaction or making money. And that is a purpose that every religious community serves. And the way our society is structured now, that happens on the side. The real stuff is the economic stuff and the making of the money and the things and the consumption. And then to make sure people stay happy enough, they have these religious communities on the side that sort of fulfill those other needs. And so the religious communities become subjected to the needs of that are officially understood as economic. And that relationship needs to be reversed. It has to be that the thing that we get out of religious community, the non-transactional, the relationships that are based on meaning and not on acquisition, that becomes the guiding force. But that's kind of airy-fairy idealism without tachlis, without a practical way to explain how you're going to get there. You were both asking about what can we do as far as activism. So one of the lessons of Shemitah and Shabbat is that sometimes the most important thing isn't the activism. So we fix the world in some ways by letting go of the need to fix the world. Like we should have our 6 days of fixing the world. It shouldn't just be about making money. It should be about fixing the world, right? But then we have that one day where we let the world be as if it were already fixed in our eyes. You know, our ancestors did that. They did Shabbat even in the direst of circumstances, even when it would have been very, very hard for them to look around and say, this world is good the way it is. That's the message of Shabbat, right? God ends creation, finishes creation, and God looks at everything that God created and says, Vehine tov ma'od, this is very good. So finding a point every week where you can step back and say, I still recognize that this is very good. Yeah, these things are happening. That's happening. And still, God made a very good creation, and I'm part of it. That's an essential part of what Shemitah teaches and what Shabbat teaches also. It's not just about what can we do to fix things. As the IPCC report makes clear, we're not going to be able to fix things. We're going to be able to prevent them from getting as broken as they possibly could if we do something now. And it's not even clear that we're going to do that. Teshuvah can affect who you are, but it can't affect what's already happened in the world. It can't undo an extinction. So we're in that world where the question is not, will there be a mass extinction, but will it be 20% of the animals or 80% of the animals? Even though we can't stop global climate disruption, we can determine to a large degree how much will survive and how much care we will give to what survives. So Shabbat, the learning about being, the priority of being over doing, is an essential part of developing the spiritual resilience so that we can save what can be saved, mourn what needs to be mourned, and love what can be loved.
Wow. Thank you so much, David, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thanks, Lex. Thank you, Dan. There's so much more to say, but I'm so glad you gave me an opportunity to say so much already. I really, really appreciate your work.
And we, of course, appreciate yours. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. We want to close out this episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us and encouraging you to take our On Yeshiva classes, our semester-long courses that Dan mentioned at the top. You can check those out at www.judaismunbound.com/ UnYeshiva. That's UnYeshiva. We would love to have you take either both of our fall courses, and you can check out our asynchronous courses that are also accessible from that page. And now the ways you can be in touch with us. First, you can head to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram pages. Those are all at Judaism Unbound. You can head to our website, judaismunbound.com, and you can email us at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we like to make is that we deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you're able to send our way, and you can do that on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift via www.judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.